This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The Netflix satirical animated series BoJack Horseman was created by my guest Raphael Bob Waxberg, who's also the showrunner. Season 5 is now on Netflix. Comedy Central is now showing the first season. The series satirizes Hollywood and deals with issues like success and failure, ego, power, addiction, relationships, and sexism. Season 5 is set in the era of the Me Too movement. BoJack Horseman takes advantage of the kind of characters that you can pull off in an animated series. It's a world that's a mix of people and talking animals with human characteristics. BoJack is a horse who became famous as the star of the 90s sitcom Horsin' Around. But when season one of BoJack Horseman begins, BoJack is washed up, his celebrity has faded, and he spends a lot of time drinking, feeling sorry for himself, and watching old reruns of his sitcom Horsin' Around, admiring how great he was on the show back then. Let's start with a clip from the very first episode of BoJack Horseman, when BoJack is a guest on the Charlie Rose Show.
In 1987, situation comedy Horsin' Around premiered on ABC. The show, in which a young bachelor horse is forced to reevaluate his priorities when he agrees to raise three human children, was initially dismissed by critics as broad and saccharine and not good. But the family comedy struck a chord with America and went on to air for 9 seasons. The star of Horsin' Around, BoJack Horseman, is our guest tonight. Welcome, BoJack.
It is good to be here, Charlie.
Okay. Raphael Bob Waxberg, welcome to Fresh Air. Time changes how we see things, doesn't it?
Yes.
When you did that Charlie Rose opening, you probably had no idea that he would be accused by multiple women of sexual harassment and that would lead to the loss of his job. So let's just start with the surprise of that for you. Did you think of that opening episode when the women stepped forward?
It really dates the show, doesn't it, to have Charlie Rose be the voice of sober reason. That, you know, look at BoJack, who's such a mess and a Lothario and unprofessional, and Charlie Rose, played in this clip by Patton Oswalt, is our straight person in the scene. And, when the allegations against Charlie Rose came out, I don't want to say my first thought was, oh no, my show! Because it wasn't. It was truly, oh no, Charlie Rose, that and all the women that he allegedly targeted. That's terrible. But it is interesting now to go back to that first episode and look at it and think about how times have changed.
So how did you come up with the idea of starting a series with a horse that can talk and walk on two legs and dress and be bitter like a human being and have him be the washed-up star of a family sitcom?
Well, the idea for the show really started from my friendship with Lisa Hanawalt, who is a brilliant illustrator and cartoonist. And I have been friends with her since high school. And when I was, you know, in Los Angeles pitching shows around, she was living in Brooklyn at the time. And one thing she was doing was just drawing these animal people on her own and posting them in her blog and on the internet. And I thought they were just so gorgeous, these designs of these characters, which were human from the neck down, more or less, with these animal heads. And so I started thinking about, is there a show that I could write with these animal people? So that's kind of where the animal people part comes into it, where the bitterness and isolation and melancholy and cynicism comes into it. I guess that would be my half of the equation. I was living in Los Angeles, and I just moved here from New York myself. And the first place I ever lived here in L.A. was as a friend of a friend's house. I'd somehow, you know, found a connection to, and it was like this tiny little closet of a bedroom in this gigantic, gorgeous house in the Hollywood Hills. And I remember there were rumors amongst the other people living there that it was the third highest elevated house in all of Hollywood, that Johnny Depp had lived there once. And it was this very, you know, fancy, very L.A. house with a pool and a deck overlooking the city. And I got there and I was this nobody and I didn't know anybody in town. And there was this winding, treacherous road up to get there, which I was terrified of taking. And I felt so disconnected from everything. And that idea of feeling simultaneously on top of the world and also never more alone and isolated was the beginning of this character for me. And I wanted to make a show about a character who'd had every opportunity for success and still couldn't find a way to be happy. And then mixing that with Lisa's animal drawings was the pitch.
So Bojack is a horse who's raising three human children in the sitcom Horsin' Around. Is that inspired by, like, Different Strokes, about a white, wealthy businessman whose wife is deceased? He's living on Park Avenue, and he adopts his late housekeeper's two children who are African-American. And so it's this, like, unusual blended family that all the comedy is built around.
It's actually based on a lot of things. I mean, Different Strokes is certainly an inspiration. Full House, The Brady Bunch, Step by Step. I mean, I think in the 70s and 80s and 90s, there are a lot of sitcoms about different family units and blended families and odd configurations of families and different ideas of what makes a family. So it felt very appropriate that in our world where we have animals and people coexisting, that there would be a show about a horse bachelor raising three human kids and learning how to make a family together.
So did you grow up on those TV shows?
I did. Yeah. I'm a big fan of those shows. The TGIF ABC lineup was a big part of my childhood. I grew up Jewish and, you know, we could never go out on Friday nights. So we would stay in and watch family television together. And those shows mean a lot to me. And, you know, one thing that I really enjoy exploring on BoJack Horseman is our culture's relationship with these, you know, some might say cheesy sitcoms of the 80s and 90s. And also BoJack's own relationship with being a part of it, that even in BoJack's ambivalence about being on this show, that he knows it's not the height of art and sophistication, but there are real people who come to him and say, this show meant a lot to me, and it means something, and I like that.
While we're on the subject of cheesy, Horsin' Around, the show that BoJack starred in, had a theme song, and not many TV shows have theme songs anymore that explain the premise of the show.
Yeah.
And so I love that Horsin' Around actually has a theme song explaining what the show is about. So I thought we could listen to the theme song.
Three little orphans, one, two, three, without a home or a family tree.
So that's the theme song for the show within a show on BoJack Horseman. So, Raphael, why did you want a theme song for Horsin' Around?
Well, you know, like you said, you don't hear theme songs, certainly not expository theme songs so much in this day and age, but it does feel like a staple of those shows. Like, I think The Brady Bunch is the perfect example of, oh, in case you're just tuning in, here is the premise of the show. This is who these characters are. This is how it works. And it felt like a really fun way in. Like, I thought if you heard this song, you would immediately know what kind of show this is.
Since BoJack is a horse, did you ever watch Mr. Ed? You're too young to have grown up with it, but was that an influence at all? And he, too, like the BoJack Horseman series within the series, Horsin' Around, he, too, had a theme song that kind of explained the premise of the show, that he was a talking horse.
I have seen a little Mr. Ed. It is slightly before my time. But I think the nature of being my age is that when I stayed home sick from school, I didn't have cable. So I would just watch whatever was on TV, which was often older reruns. So I do have a bit of pop culture knowledge outside of my own experience. And certainly part of the original pitch was, what's Mr. Ed like behind the scenes, right? When Mr. Ed goes home after shooting, who is he really? And that was a helpful way to think about the series.
When I first started watching BoJack, I thought, oh, this is such a funny show about the tropes of popular culture. And then, like, the deeper I got into it, I thought, like, wow, there's some really, like, emotionally upsetting things that happen in this. you know, BoJack is an alcoholic, he's mean, he's sexist. He has this ongoing monologue, self-destructive monologue in his head about how much he hates himself and how much he knows he's always doing the wrong thing. And so what he does is drink more. Things sometimes get, like, really dark. And at the risk of giving something away from an earlier season, I'll say that Sarah Lynn, who is the actress who plays BoJack's daughter, adopted daughter on BoJack's sitcom, Horsin' Around, after she gets out of rehab years later and he invites her to get high, which he should never have done, she just got out of rehab, she ends up ODing at, you know, toward the end of the episode, and it's kind of shocking. I mean, you know, it's a comedy, it's animated, but you're really emotionally unprepared for that.
Yeah, I think the pitch for the show, you know, when I went into Netflix, was always that it's going to start like your typical animated comedy, and it's going to feel like, as you're watching, like, oh, I get this, I get what it is. And over the course of the first season, it was going to reveal itself to the audience as being something more and darker and more interesting. And kind of the goal was, by the time you get to the end of the first season, you're thinking, oh my God, I care about these characters. When did that happen? They tricked me. And so that transition was really exciting to me, and the idea that, oh, people aren't necessarily going to know what this is going in. And one thing we've really found is that it is a very silly cartoon universe, but it can also, I think maybe because of that, go to some very sincere, dark, melancholy, and even tragic places. And that maybe in a live action show, some of these story beats would feel maudlin or saccharine or, you know, misery porny. But because it's animated and it's like a horse and it's bright and colorful, it just takes on a different feel. And you can kind of sneak attack into sadness in some fun, surprising ways.
I like that. Sneak attack into sadness and in some fun ways.
In some fun ways. Exactly. Yeah.
That's the kind of sadness I like. The fun version.
Me too.
So in this era of the Me Too movement where so many men have so much to apologize for, one of the funny things that you've come up with for the series, or you and the writers, is the We Forgive You Awards. You created a whole award ceremony for people who need to apologize for something. Would you describe the Forgivees, the We Forgiveness Awards?
Sure. The We Forgive You Awards, as presented on the show, are awards that celebrities get when the industry has decided to forgive them. So we have a character we made up called Vance Wagner, who's gotten into some trouble in the past, and he's being presented a We Forgive You Award from, I think, four-time Forgivee recipient Arnold Schwarzenegger. And one of the sad/funny things about this comedy/drama and the making of it is when we first started writing the season last year, last summer, we were talking about how sad it is that our industry is so quick to forgive these, you know, really terrible men who do awful things, and they're able to just kind of like slink back into the limelight, and we wanted to satirize that. And then over the course of the last year, it started to feel like, oh, wait a second, maybe there's been like a huge sea change in our industry. All of a sudden, it feels like we're holding men accountable and we're kicking them out of the industry. And then just in the last month or so, it started to feel like, oh no, wait, maybe we're forgiving everyone again? I don't know. Maybe this is sadly relevant anew. So it feels like, oh, we're really, you know, on top of the last month of pop culture news, when in fact we were describing this thing that's been happening for years and years.
What makes you think that people are being forgiven again?
Well, it was announced that Mel Gibson is co-writing and directing a new movie for Warner Brothers. And I don't know if I guess we've forgotten his anti-Semitic remarks, his homophobic remarks, his threats against his domestic partner, the allegations that he beat her, his use of racial slurs. It mystifies me in this era that we're in, where we're claiming to hold men accountable, that it still feels like we are not. You know, Louis C.K. Did a stand-up set a little ways back and got a standing ovation. There are reports that Garrison Keillor and Matt Lauer are planning their comebacks. I think that there is work that those men can be doing to better themselves, and I would personally love to hear about it. I would be happy if they wanted to come back and do an interview and reflect on their misdeeds and talk about what they've learned. And then I think from there, maybe we can, you know, think about their professional development. And I feel like we're going about this backwards, and I find it tremendously upsetting.
My guest is Raphael Bob Waksberg, the creator and showrunner of the Netflix animated satirical series BoJack Horseman. We'll talk more after a break. And Justin Chang will review the new film, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, starring Melissa McCarthy as a biographer turned literary forger. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Raphael Bob Waksberg, the creator and showrunner of the Netflix animated series BoJack Horseman. It's a satire about Hollywood, success, failure, depression, addiction, and the human condition in general. Although many of the characters are not human, they're talking animals with human characteristics. Season 5 is currently on Netflix, and Season 1 is now being shown on Comedy Central. So you've said that you regret some of the jokes from the first season and some of the ways BoJack's bad behavior, like sleeping with his co-stars, being drunk all the time, being mean to people. You just kind of regret turning some of those things into jokes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I think regret is maybe a strong word, and I don't know what a better word would be, so we can go with regret. And it's not necessarily that we had BoJack doing these things, because I think it is part of the character, and I do think that we have fully investigated these actions, and I think we've taken great pains to try not to glamorize who BoJack is. But I think I have a firmer understanding of the power of narrative and the power of humor. I think in the context of the show we were making and in the context of animated shows in general, and at the time when the show came out, and also just TV shows about, let's say, bad dudes or, you know, dirtbags, I think there is a kind of joke where it feels like you're like holding someone to task, but really you're playing it as like kind of cute or funny. And I don't know if we always landed on the right line of that. But I think there are moments in season one where maybe it feels like we're not just letting him off the hook, but kind of taking his perspective on things, right? So if he says a sexist thing, or if he, you know, dismisses somebody, the obvious joke is not, oh, he's a boor and he shouldn't be saying this. It almost feels like we're saying, oh, isn't it? It's kind of cool and funny that he's saying this, even though we know we shouldn't be saying it. Like, don't you kind of wish that you could say these things too? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't intentional, but I think it's slippery. And I think that happens sometimes without us meaning to. And I think there are a lot of comedy writers, and I would include myself on this, who sometimes think we have a better handle on what we're saying than we actually do. And there's a kind of comedy that I think you could call ironic sexism or post-racism or, yes, our character is saying this thing, but we, you know, the voice of the show, don't agree with it. And I think that distinction is maybe more slippery than people allow themselves to believe. I don't know if you have the control over that you think you do, about how that goes out into the world and how people internalize that humor. You know, I grew up in the era of South Park, and I think South Park is a brilliant show. And I think there's so much that they do well, and they've made me think about a lot of things in new ways. But they also have a lot of jokes about Jews. And I remember being in middle school and high school and people like making jokes about me that they got from South Park. And obviously, if you asked Matt and Trey, they would say, well, Cartman is not a role model. Like, you're not supposed to think he's like cool or funny or charming. But I think middle school or high school me, who is the butt of those jokes, would say, well, what's the difference? You know, what does that mean to me? And I think I am also guilty of making jokes like that in the mouth of BoJack or some of our other characters, and not always thinking about what are the longer ramifications of this on our culture.
Is there an example you can give of that, of a joke that you maybe regret or wish you had placed differently in it contextually?
Sure. I can give a couple examples. You know, I think a big one, which I feel very comfortable talking about, is a lot of the Jewish jokes we have had throughout the show. And it's something that I myself, as a Jew, feel some ownership of and feel comfortable with. And there's a lot of Holocaust jokes. And I think maybe I believed in season one and two that we were past anti-Semitism. And I think now I look around the world and I think that was naive on my part. And I think we were not as past it as I had convinced myself that we were and thought that we were. And now some of those jokes in the early seasons just hit me a little differently. Another joke about somebody that I am not is we have a joke in season two. And BoJack is a very boorish character. And we had a gag where he's going on this press tour and everyone's worried that he's going to say something offensive. And they're going to Alaska. And he has a line about, we're going to Alaska. What am I going to say that's going to offend a bunch of inbred Eskimo blubber munchers is the line. And, you know, on paper, I can defend that joke. And I can say, no, the joke of that is not on the Alaskans. It's about how stupid BoJack is and how he doesn't realize. And clearly the way it's set up is, oh, he is saying this offensive thing and not even knowing that it's offensive. So I feel like technically we are in the right on this joke. But someone tweeted at me a couple years ago and said, you know, I am a native Alaskan myself, and I was watching your show, and there is not a lot of representation for my people on television. And to watch this show make this joke about my people, and knowing that this was the only reference in the show of my people, and knowing that nobody who works on the show is of my people, it hurt. And I cannot then say, no, but you are wrong because I did it correctly. You misinterpreted it, so you are wrong to be offended. I have to hear that note and go, oh, you're right. Maybe we weren't as careful about that as we should have been.
I know some comics feel it's become actually very difficult to do comedy because there's always somebody calling you out for saying something politically incorrect. So I'm wondering how you've changed the writing on the show with this kind of sensitivity that you feel you didn't have in the first season and that you're trying to have now?
Well, I mean, first of all, who says comedy should be easy? Like, why do you get a free pass? Like, oh, this is making my job harder. Yeah, boo-hoo. That's what happens in life. Sometimes there are challenges in your job or your career, and you have to, like, learn how to take them. And I think it's a good thing. And I think this means that more people are being heard, because I don't think all of a sudden, just because I saw that tweet, I don't think that means that people were not offended or hurt by my humor before. It just means now I can see it and now I am aware of it. And I think that is a good thing. And I think it is a challenge to challenge your own preconceived notions of what is okay or what is funny or who are you making your comedy for. And I think if you are a comedian who doesn't care about that, then fine, make the comedy for the people that will not be offended, and that will be your audience. You know, I want to make comedy that people who are perhaps disenfranchised or marginalized can enjoy. I don't want my comedy to exclude them. So it's a challenge that I take on. And it's sometimes hard to get that feedback when people say, hey, this really hurt me, because my ego wants to say, no, it didn't, you know, because I want to feel like, right. I am smart. I am good. I'm a good guy. You don't understand. I have good intentions. But I think hearing that really helps me. And I don't want to get to a place where I'm not hearing those notes, or I feel like I don't have to hear those notes, because I think it makes me a better, more sensitive and more interesting writer.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Raphael Bob Waksberg is the creator and showrunner of the Netflix series BoJack Horseman. Season 5 is now on Netflix. Season 1 is being shown on Comedy Central. Our film critic Justin Chang has a review of the new movie Can You Ever Forgive Me? It's adapted from a memoir by Lee Israel, a New York writer who in the early 1990s began forging letters attributed to literary luminaries like Dorothy Parker and Noel Coward and selling them to unsuspecting collectors. The movie stars Melissa McCarthy as Israel and co-stars Richard E. Grant. It's directed by Mariel Heller. Here's Justin's review.
Can You Ever Forgive Me is a rare gem. A sweet movie about a mean person, in which the sweetness and the meanness don't cancel each other out. It reminds us that in the right hands, a misanthrope can make positively joyous company, especially if she has the good fortune to be played by Melissa McCarthy. As Lee Israel, a struggling biographer turned literary con artist, McCarthy gets more expressive nuances out of an angry scowl than I'd have thought any actor could manage. When we first meet Lee in 1991, she's being fired from an office job for cursing and drinking, leaving her unable to pay the rent on her cluttered Manhattan apartment or her cat's medical bills. Her writing career has stalled, and her agent, played by a snappy Jane Curtin, tells her that no one is interested in her or the new Fanny Bryce biography she's working on. Desperate for money, Lee sells off a framed thank you letter she once received from Katharine Hepburn, and learns that there's a real market for celebrity correspondence, the dishier the better. And so begins her criminal career. She uses her old-school typewriter to forge letters by the likes of Dorothy Parker and Lillian Hellman, then sells them to used bookstores for a few $100 a pop. The movie's attention to process is fascinating. We see her practicing Noel Coward's signature and baking her letters in the oven so that the paper will look yellow with age. But the real work is in the writing, and Lee takes genuine pride in it, channeling her flair for words into inspired feats of mimicry. She becomes a fraud and an artist at the same time. Every grifter needs an accomplice, and Lee's is a man named Jack Hawk, played by a droll and deliciously funny Richard E. Grant. Jack is a drifter, with little money and no permanent address, just some street smarts and plenty of hustle. And he quickly latches on to Lee after running into her at a bar one evening.
Last time I saw you, thank you, we were both pleasantly pissed at some horrible book card. Am I right?
It's slowly flooding back to me. You're friends with, Julia
Steinberg?
Yeah.
She's not an agent anymore. She died.
She did? Jesus, that's young.
Maybe she didn't die. Maybe she just moved back to the suburbs. I was confused there, too. No, that's right. She got married and had twins.
Better to have died.
Indeed. I've just come from having my teeth bleached. How do they look?
Why would you do that?
Oh, teeth are a dead giveaway.
Okay.
Can I buy you a drink? Even though you're the posh writer?
Thank you.
Can You Ever Forgive Me becomes, among other things, an acerbic Valentine to 90s New York, a world of bars and bookstores crammed with people who deploy the English language with devilish wit and style. The fact that Lee and Jack are both gay quietly underlines their status as outsiders. At one point, Lee is caught off guard by the gently romantic overtures of a bookseller, nicely played by Dolly Wells, and we see just how ill-accustomed she is to receiving human kindness, much less responding in kind. Despite the turn into bleaker, more downbeat territory, Can You Ever Forgive Me feels like the movie Melissa McCarthy has been working toward her entire career. As we've seen from her performances in Spy and Bridesmaids, she has always been a splendid comedian and a genius of madcap improvisation. But the lows that have dotted her uneven body of work have made it clear that even a dynamite actress needs a sharp script and a good director to soar. She gets both those things here. The director is Marielle Heller, who tackles this character portrait with the same clear-eyed touch that distinguished her 2015 filmmaking debut, The Diary of a Teenage Girl. The screenplay is by Nicole Holofcener, an excellent director herself, and Jeff Witte. They've written a terrific script about the rewards and agonies of being a writer. You might think that Lee Israel, a professional crank who prefers cats to people, is a character only a critic could love. But Lee's crankiness is genuinely captivating, in part because it's so uncompromising. Her talent as a writer goes hand in hand with the harsh, jaundiced way she sees the world. The title, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, which comes from one of those fake Dorothy Parker letters, is clearly meant to be read sarcastically. Lee Israel didn't need redemption. She needed a chance to let her talent speak for itself, even if it meant speaking through another writer's mouth. But Israel got her due. In 2008, 6 years before her death, she wrote about her criminal misadventures in a book that the New York Times hailed as pretty damned fabulous. The same can be said of this movie.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, we hear from artist and writer Jarrett J. Krasoska, whose new graphic memoir is nominated for a National Book Award. It's about how he grew up with a mother addicted to heroin. He was raised by his grandparents. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is nominated for a National Book Award for his memoir, Hey Kiddo, How I Lost My Mother, Found My Father, and Dealt with Family Addiction. It's a graphic memoir, which is to say it's a book of text and illustration, kind of like a comic geared to young adults. But I'm an adult, and I loved it. Jarrett J. Krasoska was about to turn 3 when his grandparents insisted on taking legal custody of him because of his mother's heroin addiction and related problems that prevented her from taking care of him. She was in and out of rehab with a stint in prison while he was growing up. The book is written from the point of view of his 17-year-old self, looking back on his childhood and teenage years. Krasoska wasn't an athletic boy and wasn't good at socializing, so drawing was his refuge, his way of making friends, and his way of dealing with life. Krasoska is also known for his series of graphic novels for young people, including Lunch Lady and the Platypus Police Squad series, as well as arcs in the Star Wars Jedi Academy series. He uses the middle initial J, Jarrett J. Krasoska, in his official author name as a tribute to his late grandfather, who was named Joseph. Jarrett Krasoska, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on being a finalist for the National Book Award.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry Gross.
So did you go out of your way for many years not to tell people that your mother had been a heroin addict?
Oh, throughout my childhood, it's something I definitely kept hidden. When my grandparents finally told me, I was in the 4th grade, and I'll never forget, they called me into the living room. And I remember thinking, oh, maybe we're going to go on another family vacation, because the last time we had a family meeting, they told me we were going to Disney World, and it was fantastic. And my grandfather, he sat me down on the couch, and he said, it's time we tell you the truth about your mother, and she's in jail, and she's a drug addict, and that's why she's been gone all this time. Now, that was 4th grade. Now, she had been gone and in and out since I was 2 years old. So I didn't tell anybody for the longest time. I trusted one friend, my friend Patrick, my best friend I grew up next door to, and I didn't tell anyone. I mean, it's when you have these addictions in your families, I mean, you sort of live this duality. You have this thing that you sort of hold back from people, and then you put your best face forward. You know, as I got older, sometimes I would share stories with people in high school somewhat. But it wasn't really until I delivered what I call an accidental TED Talk in 2012 that I shared that story more widely.
But people must have asked you, kids must have asked you all the time, like, how come your grandparents are raising you? Where's your parents?
They would, and I would just make up stories. Oh, my father, he travels a lot for business. Or, you know, you would just find ways to sort of deflect, right, to say, I mean, maybe that's where my storytelling skills began, by making up excuses for where my biological parents were.
Yeah, well, your mother was in jail in halfway houses. Your father, you didn't even know who he was.
I didn't learn his first name until I was in 6th grade.
So you've written about your childhood and your mother in the form of a graphic memoir for young adults. Though I'm an adult, and I really liked it. I would recommend this to adults. But why did you want to, like, target it to young adults?
Well, you know, I've made a career out of writing and illustrating books for young people. You know, I have picture books. I have graphic novels for the middle grade reader. Middle grade is, you know, 7 to 11 years old. And I knew I always wanted to share the story visually, based on the intensity of the subject matter and my grandmother's salty language alone, I knew this needed to be for an older audience. And I've always been obsessed with coming-of-age stories, that moment in a person's life where they decide who they want to be, or the world is, you know, projecting them out into the world in such a way that says, okay, this is my path. And for me, that really was my senior year of high school. So many things were happening. Obviously, one gets their license. That's a big game changer. I met my father for the first time. Things came to head with my mother. And I was, you know, leaving the home that I grew up in to pursue my dreams via art college. So it seemed like a natural for me to tell that perspective from that 17-year-old self. The story is told through the perspective of the 17-year-old Jarrett. And, you know, it's funny. I didn't really think of it as a quote-unquote, you know, grown-up book. But really, a lot of grown-ups have been reading it and responding to it and identifying with it because, you know, addiction touches so many of us, either directly or just we're just one degree away from it, it seems.
So are there details about your mother that you felt were too upsetting to put in a book for young people?
I've been working on this book in one way or another since the early 2000s. And every time I would sit down to write it, I would stop and hesitate because I would worry to myself, well, what are people going to think? And at first it was, what are the people in the book going to think, you know, if I'm writing about them? And I would stop and hesitate. And then as my career grew and I became known as the lunch lady guy, I have a series of graphic novels about a lunch lady who fights crime, and it's campy and it's funny. And I thought, wow, is writing a book on this subject matter going to be in such contrast to that those happy books that I would be putting my career on the line? As I traveled the country and I met more and more and more young people who were dealing with this, I realized that this was sort of a responsibility for me to write this book. I mean, you know, to go with the theme of comic books, with great power becomes great responsibility. Now I have this audience of these kids who grew up with my books, and I feel like I owe it to these readers to put myself out there. And I realized that if I was going to write memoir, I had to just write it without any inhibition. And I wrote down the expression, and I'll censor this for the radio, but I said, write like you don't give an F. And not that I don't care about the craft, but I can't worry about negative opinions. You know, I have to just write this and put it out there. So there are some things I learned about my mother later on in life, but I couldn't give some of that knowledge to that 17-year-old protagonist because that would have really affected his relationship with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one particular scene, because I did have to explain how my mother fully went away. You know, what would take this woman away from her 2-year-old, almost 3-year-old son? And this is something I learned as an adult. And I was able to find a way to share that in the story, but not give that knowledge to the protagonist. And when I was a toddler, she was in a very abusive relationship. And her boyfriend at the time came home, and he and his colleague had a drug deal gone bad, and they had murdered somebody. And my mother helped them clean up and dispose of the evidence. And that's the big reason why she went away.
Can you imagine how upsetting that would have been to you as a child?
Oh, it was upsetting to me as an adult. I mean, I learned about it right before the birth of my first child.
Oh.
And so I kind of, you know what, let me just mentally shelve that so I can focus on being a dad to this human being that I don't know how to take care of. And then some years later, you know, when I was really digging and researching this book, I realized narratively, I have to explain to the readers fully why she's going away for so long. You know, you don't go away that long for shoplifting at the mall or for stealing batteries from a convenience store. And I'll tell you, like, you might be the sixth or seventh person I've ever said that out loud to, Terry. And I share that for those young readers out there who are dealing with heady issues at home. So it took a long time for me to gain that courage to make this book.
Now I really understand why your grandparents insisted on getting legal custody of you, because they were afraid you'd become a ward of the state.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And they also were afraid I would get hurt. And what's interesting too is for you know, I have a daughter and she's 9, she'll be 10 soon, and Hey Kiddo has been the sort of the forbidden fruit in our house. She's really wanted to read it.
I was wondering about that, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, imagine, okay, here's your family history too, you know, child. So I sat down with her. And I explained to her a lot of the aspects of this book before she would read it, and also made sure she read it before the book was published, so a classmate didn't come in and say, oh, I know this about your family, and she didn't. And Zoe is so intuitive, and she has such a big heart. When she heard this story, she immediately said, well, she probably went along with it because she was maybe afraid that she would get murdered, or maybe they would murder you as a baby as well.
Wow. You know, one of the stories you tell in the book is that when you started living with your grandparents, you were shocked that they made breakfast for you. Because even before you were 3, when you were living with your mother, you'd wake up to an empty house and have to make your own breakfast.
That's true. And I remember them telling me this. And, you know, again, sometimes things as an adult come at you and you learn about these different aspects of your youth. And this isn't in the book because, again, this is something that I would have learned later. After my grandparents passed, I created an art scholarship in their name at the Worcester Art Museum, where I attended classes. And to sort of kickstart this scholarship and let people know this was happening, I had an exhibit at the Worcester Art Museum. And it was also coincided with my 10-year anniversary of getting published. And a woman came through the line with her children, and they excitedly got their book signed. And after they got their book signed, they, you know, a couple steps away, and they were chatting with their friend. They didn't realize they were within earshot of my wife, Gina. And this woman said, you know, the last time I saw him, he was a baby, and I was his mother's parole officer. And I went on the house to do a wellness check, and he was a baby crying alone in his crib by himself, no one else in the house.
Wow.
And there I was, you know, signing books. So it's wild. You know, there was certainly moments when, you know, I was in more physical jeopardy than I'd ever realized. But thankfully, I had, while I didn't have my birth parents to take care of me, I had other family members who took care of me as if they were my parents.
So your grandparents sound like they were very loving toward you, but that they had pretty gruff personalities, particularly your grandmother. I want you to describe how you draw your grandmother and how you draw your grandmother's cigarettes, which are typically hanging from her lips.
Yes. My grandparents loved me so much. And, you know, despite all of the trauma that I was surrounded by, their love flowed in me through life. And they're just about a decade gone now, and I still very much feel that love, and it very much keeps me afloat. They were tricky people, though, you know. They drank quite a bit. In fact, they were better when I was young than when my mother was young. My grandmother could at times be violently drunk when she was younger. I guess I could sum up my grandmother with this. I'd come home from school, and somebody wronged me, and I'd tell the story about how this kid wronged me. She would take the cigarette out of her mouth and say, just tell them to go in their hat. No, at the time, I was in third grade. And it sounds like such this like Great Depression, World War II put down. And here I am in the 80s. Am I going to go back to school, tell a kid that? They were so lovingly crass, though. You know, they'd curse around, but it was never directed towards me. And I remember they once said, like, you know, we're okay if you curse, but if you ever curse at us, you are in a significant amount of trouble, young man. You know, they smoked 2 packs a day each, non-filtered.
Wow.
And my grandfather just bemoaned this movement of having places be non-smoking. You know, airplanes, you can't smoke on the plane. Like, what an inconvenience. To the point where he said, Jesus Christ, by the time I die, I'm going to get to heaven. And they're going to say, sorry, no smoking.
Well, he died of lung cancer.
He died, at 81.
Okay. So and he outlived your grandmother.
By a couple of years,
who
yeah.
was also a heavy smoker. Right.
Well, also a heavy smoker.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I should say, too, she died the summer before my wedding. And unfortunately, she died on a Friday. My wife's wedding shower was that Sunday. And in the months leading up to that, you know, my fiance at the time, Gina, now my wife, she'd be over. And my grandmother was hooked up to oxygen. And we always had thought that she just had a bad bladder because she would always excuse herself to go to the bathroom. And Gina's like, you know, she's smoking in there, right, with the oxygen around her nose.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
It's so dangerous. We're so lucky the house didn't explode.
Yeah. Were you afraid that you'd be using drugs because your mother did and because your grandparents drank a lot? Like, how did that affect you when you got old enough to consider alcohol or drugs?
Yeah, I always feared that I would fall into those same steps. So I was always very prudish about having a drink or anything like that. And I knew addiction was in the family. I knew it was hereditary. And I knew that it was dangerous territory to dabble in things. So, you know, come college, I remember my freshman year of college, and I was at University of Hartford. I wasn't at Rhode Island School of Design just yet. I remember that you're suddenly given this freedom and you're drinking all the time. And I remember sort of hitting a wall of like, whoa, like I'm drinking almost every single day. This isn't healthy. This isn't good. I need to get out of this situation because I don't want to fall into that same trap of that both my birth parents had stuff and addictions, and there were addictions on both sides. So I was always very wary and very careful of that. And my mother was a very talented artist. And when she was incarcerated, she would send me letters and she would draw cartoons for me. And a big part of how we communicated for many years was through art. So she would draw me Snoopy, and then she would request maybe I draw her the Pink Panther. So then I would draw her the Pink Panther, and then I would write back and request Garfield. And I remember as a very young person seeing how talented she was. But she had sort of squandered that talent because of the drugs. And that really was my driving force to want to get published. You know, I was submitting book proposals to publishers when I was a junior in college.
You know, when you're writing from the point of view as a child in your graphic memoir, Hey Kiddo, you confront your mother and say to her, you chose drugs over me.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see it now as an adult?
Having seen the fact that she couldn't help herself to the very end, you know, the mindset has shifted some in that she did choose, for whatever reason, to use drugs, and she used at such an early age. So it's hard to, you know, how to judge.
She started when she was 13?
13 years old. You know, my grandparents got her own place when she was 15, thinking that would solve the problem. Well, if you give a 15-year-old their own place, what's going to happen? She wasn't able to help herself at the throughout her life. She just kept going back to it. The one thing that I do still have a heavy heart for is she still was never able to take ownership. So yes, she had a disease, and yes, she suffered from addiction, but she was never able to say, oh yeah, sorry about that. You know, she's still, even as an adult, she'd say, you had everything you needed. Like, when are you just going to get over it? Sure, I had Nintendo and I had all of these G.I. Joes and Thundercat action figures, but I didn't have her. And the tough part really is knowing who she was and what her heart was, that she would have been such a good mother and such a great grandmother if she had the whereabouts to do that.
It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and good luck at the National Book Awards.
Thank you. You know, I got to say, I listen to this show so much. This feels like it was a Choose Your Own Adventure podcast. Like, I couldn't just sit and draw and listen to you. I'm like, oh, wait, she's talking to me. Thank you.
How are we going to end the adventure? By saying thank you to each other.
Yeah, and I'll say it was really an honor. Thank you, Terry Gross.
Until the next time, thank you. Jarrett J. Krasowska is the author of the new graphic memoir, Hey Kiddo, How I Lost My Mother, Found My Father, and Dealt with Family Addiction. The book is nominated for a National Book Award for Young People's Literature. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.